Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Supreme Court's Oddball Playlist.
Freedom of speech!
Citing the principle of money equals speech, the Supreme Court opens the floodgates for corporate money into political campaigns. I guess then more money equals more speech.
So it's just going to be more money overall for everybody. And more painful 30-second sound bites for all the public to have to endure.
A stimulus package for political campaigns, because corporations are people too.
Freedom of speech!
The court speaks on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, January 22nd, and The Takeaway is money does equal speech, according to the Supreme Court, and we'll be dealing with it in the 2010 campaign. I'm here with Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, John. Nobody paid me to say that.
That's good. And Celeste will be back on Monday.
Yes, she will. That's right. And I'll be sleeping in. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. As we've been talking about, the Supreme Court yesterday struck down a century-old restriction on corporations using their money in elections. A 5-4 decision says big business and labor unions have the same First Amendment rights as individuals. The Brookings Institution, Darrell West says, it opens the door to corporate America to start advertising candidates much as they market products.
We will see an arms race of campaign spending in upcoming elections.
White House spokesman Robert Gibbs condemned the high court decision.
I don't think anybody thinks that we spend too little money on political commercials and on political campaigns.
Disclosure rules remain intact, so an outside group paying for a campaign commercial will have to include a statement taking responsibility.
For more, let's talk with Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and senior legal correspondent for Slate.com. Good morning, Dahlia.
Good morning.
So campaign finance reform is something of a joke, it seems to me, as long as there is this principle that money equals speech and that that's inviolate. Is that what this is all about?
Well, there's always been a lurking principle, at least for a while now, that money equals speech and that corporate money equals speech. What the court really did was take off all restraints on that speech. In other words, it used to be that even though the court generally accepted that money was speech, you could regulate it some for greater interests of political fairness. Those days are over. From here on in, according to Justice Kennedy's 5-4 opinion, all bets are off and speech is good.
Well, we'll be talking about the implications of this decision for the rest of our program and also probably far into the future. Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and senior legal correspondent for Slate.com. President Obama took on Wall Street yesterday, calling for tougher regulations that would limit the size of banks and limit their ability to engage in high-risk trades.
If these folks want a fight, it's a fight I'm ready to have. And my resolve is only strengthened when I see a return to old practices at some of the very firms fighting reform.
The president's plan would also stop banks from making investments that are not meant to benefit customers. The markets absolutely was thrilled by all of this. The Dow Jones lost 213 points yesterday. The decision to confront Wall Street's big banks comes at a time when President Obama is shifting his focus to jobs.
You can expect a continued, sustained, and relentless effort to create good jobs for the American people. I will not rest until we've gotten there.
Obama's focus for the past several months has been passing a health care reform bill, which now looks more difficult after this week's election in Massachusetts.
Asian and European markets are down. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,389. The S&P opens at 1,116. NASDAQ at 2,265.
So coming up in this hour, we're going to talk movies like we do every Friday and look at the first day of the Sundance Film Festival. That's later in the show. We'll have a couple of directors here. And with the Supreme Court's decision that money is speech, we're talking with all of you this morning. How do you view campaign cash? Is it political expression or a tool for corruption? The court essentially said that corporations are people. They have freedom of speech rights. So therefore, their money equals speech. Do you buy that? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or on our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, more of my conversation with Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. He's going to talk about the Haitian relief effort in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
and Miles O'Brien. Miles, it's been great having you here this week.
It's been a good week. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, Celeste will be back on Monday. And during my 2 days down in Washington, you'll recall I was out of here for a while.
In the midst of
the political crisis created by that special Senate race up in Massachusetts, and there were all kinds of typical briefings and meetings on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was the relief effort in Haiti that had the highest profile at the White House. Government agencies from Health and Human Services to USAID to the Pentagon were rapidly mobilizing. And it's estimated there are close to 16,000 U.S. troops there right now as part of the effort. In part two of our interview with Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, we talked about the challenges in Haiti, and especially in opening up that logjam at the damaged airport in Port-au-Prince.
Well, when we went in there initially, we really brought the enabling capability to make the airport 24/7 capable. Since that time, we've worked very hard with the Haitian government to essentially put ourselves in a position to run the airport. And we've increased the throughput several-fold. I just actually literally got off the phone with General Frazier, who's the commander at Southcom. He went down there yesterday, and one of the first things he mentioned was what a tremendous operation the airport is in terms of what it's doing right now. And as the principal place to get stuff into Haiti initially, the only place we could do that, that's been really important.
How much has that impressive throughput and increase of capacity there at the airport due to the forces really having to hold territory and control that airport because, of course, the tower was damaged?
Well, it wasn't really tied to holding territory per se. Certainly security there has been important, but I've received no input that there's been any kind of incidents in the vicinity of the airport or any kind of serious instance at all. So what was really key was getting in there and enabling it. And we knew this right away as rapidly as we could. What the challenge has been, because it has been the principal place where all the relief comes in, has been prioritizing it. And then after the prioritization and arrival, is distributing it, which is where we are right now in the overall task.
How does what appears to be U.S. control of the airport at Port-au-Prince conflate with the idea that the Haitians are in control of their own destiny right now? We've heard reports that the police are essentially AWOL in a lot of the urban areas and that the responsibility of the government is very, very difficult to discern right now.
Well, we've worked with the Haitian leadership from the beginning. I mean, we are there in support of the Haitian leadership. Overall, the UN in terms of the relief efforts and in particular the UN security forces supporting them from a security standpoint. But our main effort, our main focus, main goal is to provide this relief and provide security for the relief effort. So as we've approached this and recognize we're a big footprint, and I understand all that, the intent is from, and certainly from the military standpoint, the intent is to focus on this kind of assistance in support of these organizations, including the Haitian government, to relieve the really destitute situation in so many places as rapidly as we can. We also, the U.S. military is not the lead, even in our own country. It's USAID, so we're working very closely in support of USAID as well.
That's Admiral Michael Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I spoke with him Wednesday at the Pentagon, and we went on to discuss the capabilities of the Haitian government, a tough situation for that government in this time of critical need.
I'm not aware of the impact that the difficulties the Haitian government has had in standing up. I mean, it was in great part decapitated by this. They lost a lot of senior people. They also lost a lot of ministries. So it's in its own way trying to stand back up as well. So I haven't seen them impeding progress here. We certainly are in touch with them about what's going on. And again, there's a big international medical effort right now. And as literally as we speak, a little more than a week after the earthquake, while we still have a long way to go with food, a long way to go with water, a great emphasis right now is being placed on getting the medical help out there. The The Navy ship, United States Navy ship Comfort, showed up today that has a capacity for 1,000 beds. And we hope that that will assist. There's been an offer of another hospital ship as well. So, but there are clear challenges, significant challenges, that remain on the medical side that we're really trying to break through.
You know, we've talked with lots and lots of patients over the last week or more. And to a person, they tell us, we don't trust the Haitian government. We don't know who to trust inside Haiti for the relief that we need and for our faith in the future of our country.
Right.
Can you tell the Haitian people at this point, at this stage of the relief operation, who they can trust?
Well, I have great confidence in the leadership of the United Nations, the senior representatives that are there. I have great confidence in certainly the leadership in USAID and our military leadership and other leaders from many other countries. We are, as I indicated, we are there working very closely to support the Haitian government. And they are a very important part of all this. Again, they've been very badly, almost decapitated. And so I think it's, you know, it's going to take them a while to stand back up. What I guess what I'd say to the Haitian people is there is no one that I know, from their government through all the support agencies, including those from America and many countries around the world, that don't want to do anything else than help them, certainly in the near term, get this relief done, ease this burden, which has been so tough on them because of this tragedy. All of us, there isn't a moment in any of this that myself and many others don't think about all of the people who've died in this, and that just the epic tragedy that this is, and we want to try to relieve that. And I know everyone, including the Haitian government leadership, wants to do that as well.
Hopes and challenges in the Haitian relief effort. That was Admiral Michael Mullen, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, speaking with me at the Pentagon this week. You can see a video of our entire interview on the website, takeaway.org. At 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the headlines that we're following.
The president chastised big Wall Street banks yesterday, urgently calling for limits on their size and investments.
The American people will not be served by a financial system that comprises just a few massive firms. That's not good for consumers. It's not good for the economy.
The president said new regulation is imperative to avoid another economic meltdown. Investors responded by dumping bank stocks. We'll get more details from New York Times finance reporter Louise Story in just a few minutes.
I can't wait to ask her about this.
Yeah, she should have some insights for us, I think. A big win for business. That's thanks to a decision by a bitterly divided Supreme Court. The 5-4 ruling lets big businesses and unions and just rich people spend millions to directly sway presidential and congressional elections. Darrell West from the Brookings Institution explains the ruling.
It doesn't affect candidates so directly because it doesn't relate to money that you would give to a candidate, but it does allow corporations to spend an unlimited amount of money on behalf of candidates that they support.
As a side consequence, the election season blizzard of ads is bound to increase.
Moving to the Caribbean, Haitians living in the U.S. began applying for a government program that allows some immigrants to remain in the country and get work permits under the Temporary Protected Status Program called TPS. Eligible participants can work here and send money back home. Toyota announced it's recalling 2.3 million vehicles to fix sticky accelerators, causing the cars to rev at extremely high speeds. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the president talks about restrictions on banks. The markets react downwardly.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Hey, you want that to go?
Huge takeouts this morning in finance and sports. And was it a good week or a bad week? You decide. We'll find out in a moment. But first, the famous words of bank robber Willie Sutton when asked why he robbed banks. Because that's where the money is. And that's certainly where the president thinks the money is.
Banks will no longer be allowed to own, invest, or sponsor hedge funds, private equity funds, or proprietary trading operations for their own profit, unrelated to serving their customers.
Joining us is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Well, the president spoke, the markets tumbled, and this was some tough rhetoric out of the White House. What does it mean?
It's tough rhetoric, John, but, you know, I think that some people would say where the money is not in the banks. I think some people would say where the money is every January is in the bank workers' pockets when they get paid their bonuses.
Right.
And so it's not a coincidence that you're seeing, just as Wall Street workers get these massive bonuses, you're seeing the White House take a very populist stance with much stricter rules and policies and ideas for Wall Street. You know, it was just a week ago that they're coming out about taxing the banks. This week he's coming out in strong favor of the Consumer Protection Agency, which some people thought was going to be dead in Congress. And now, yesterday, you're right, he proposed, you know, what is viewed as a very, very strong approach, the strongest of his administration to the financial crisis.
And something he could have done.
Something
as
he
you
could
were saying
have
yesterday,
done a year ago.
A year ago.
And for some reason, he now has decided to take a hard stance. So what he said is three things. One, there can be no proprietary trading in banks. That's when a bank trades for its own books. Like, you know, all those mortgage bonds that the banks held that ended up causing the massive write-downs.
Right.
They were holding those on their own books. So one, they can't do that. Two, they cannot own stakes or investments in hedge funds or private equity firms. And those have proven to be incredibly profitable for banks like Goldman. They let their workers invest in them, and those turned out big returns and paid big bonuses. Three, he said, these banks cannot do any more acquisitions that will make them larger. The largest banks cannot grow bigger than 10% of all banking liabilities. And that is very interesting because, of course, it was the government during the financial crisis that pushed so many banks to merge together. So that's a bit of a reversal of the historical timeline here.
Louise Story, I guess if I'm sitting at one of those exotic finance desks over at Goldman Sachs or Citigroup, I'm a little worried about my job maybe this morning. Who knows? Louise Story, thanks so much.
Sports takeout time. This is a big weekend for football fans. What do you say?
Yeah,
the New Orleans Saints hosting the Minnesota Vikings, NFC Championship there, the Indianapolis Colts and the Jets. They're from New York, right, Ibrahim?
Oh, yeah, Our
takeaway sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Hey, let's we pulled an interesting little cut from the archives here. Let's listen.
First plays that I've been in the NFL right now have not been the best. Last year against Washington, I came in and ball got deflected and the guy picked it, went in for a touchdown. And preseason this year, the first pass I throw is a bomb for an interception. Then I come in the regular season, the first pass I complete to myself. So it's hopefully I'll do a lot better on my first passes from now on.
That's Brett Favre.
So that was Brett Favre in 1992 when he was the starting quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. It's been a long time since then, and I'm wondering today whether we're going to have a storybook performance, a storybook ending for Brett Favre. It started off kind of rusty, but now he is one of the most pure. He certainly has a Hall of Fame career. So these are the keys, I think, for the victory for each team. First of all, the offensive line of the New Orleans Saints has to perform. The Vikings have a vicious pass rush led by Jared Allen, and if they can't stop Jared Allen, they will not win the game.
That could hurt an old man if they got through that line.
It could certainly hurt an old man. The other thing is Adrian Peterson, the running back for the Vikings, he hasn't rushed for over 100 yards in 8 games. He cannot fumble the football. He has a propensity to let go of the football. So does Brett Favre. Now, if the Saints can get them to fumble the ball, or if they can get the Vikings to throw an interception, then the Saints will win the game. And that is the key to the game. Whoever wins the turnover and takeaway ratio will win this game.
Need your predictions, Ibrahim.
Well, okay, so here we go. Real quick, I just want to go to this real quick with Darren Sharper.
Okay, go.
You know, they got a lot of weapons. The thing that's going to help us is that we've seen in practice against the offense that has a lot of weapons also. So we'll be more than prepared for that.
Darren Sharper is the X factor. I'm going with the Saints in this one. He's going to get a big interception late in the game, and I'm going with the Jets.
Of course you're going with the Jets.
Yeah, I don't know. We shall see.
I don't think he's very objective.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much. Our next takeout is, of course, The Week. The magazine The Week sponsors with us a feature called Good Week, Bad Week. We want your nominations for Good Week, Bad Week. You can send them to us at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But our week segment begins with the voice of Ruth Attridge.
it is going to get bigger and bigger. If you look at the statistics, it's now, I think, about 45% of British marriages they predict is going to end in divorce. So I think we'll see more and more of these kind of services coming out.
Yes, it is a good week for divorce, Louise. Why? Because Ruth, who's the spokeswoman for the Debenham department store in London, is setting up a divorce registry. Yes, you can register your divorce.
What is the proper gift? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know. She certainly had no advice in this cut.
Divorce is an expensive time with legal fees and things like that. So a divorce list is something where family and friends can help you out with the basics.
Dead roses. Oh, that's it. Yes, dead roses.
No. Millie paid for our legal fees at the registry. Thank you very much. All right. So good week for divorce, but a bad week. This is a spooky story. Listen to this. For since 1949, a mystery man has been visiting Edgar Allan Poe's gravesite in Baltimore, Maryland, each year on the writer's birthday to leave 3 red roses and a half-filled bottle of cognac. I have no idea who it is, but this past January 19th, the roses and the cognac were a no-show, did not show up, and, they have no idea why. So what does it mean? A bad week for 19th century mystery writers. Actually, Poe is bigger than a mystery writer.
No roses, no cognac.
No,
nevermore. Nevermore.
Nevermore. That's great, man. That's why we have you on the show. If you have nominations for who had a good week or a bad week in the news, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you can see the good week, bad week feature in The Week magazine on newsstands now.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Democrats' filibuster-proof majority is broken, but why do filibusters matter? I could tell you, but it would take me about 53 hours of talking. Anyway, we'll talk about that
in a few
moments.
Please spare us.
Yes. Yeah. Here are some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court says big business and labor unions have a free speech right to spend as much money as they want to persuade voters in elections. Earlier this hour, we spoke to Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and senior legal correspondent for Slate.com.
Well, there's always been a lurking principle, at least for a while now, that money equals speech and that corporate money equals speech. What the court really did was take off all restraints on that speech.
Disclosure rules remain intact, so an outside group paying for a campaign commercial still has to include a statement taking responsibility.
Moving now to Haiti, where a massive relocation of 400,000 people is being planned. UN peacekeepers are now leveling some land on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince and say the relocation could start next week. Since 90% of the city was destroyed, former President Bill Clinton, the UN special envoy for Haiti, says there's a silver lining in the reconstruction ahead.
I personally believe that they're going to be given the opportunity to, in effect, reimagine their country.
Meanwhile, search and rescue teams are packing up their dogs and gear as hopes for finding survivors from last week's earthquake dim. This USAID worker describes the mood.
There's like a great pallor of gloom among the population. There's a very deep depression among the people. It's very evident here.
Tonight, a 2-hour celebrity telethon to benefit Haiti will air on all the major networks and cable channels. Google appears to have regained its financial stride after wobbling through most of 2009. The internet search leader made nearly $2 billion in the last 3 months of the year. For 2009, Google raked in $6.5 billion. Let's check on the markets. Asian and European markets down. Futures are mixed this morning. The Dow gets underway after a big drop yesterday, 10,389. The S&P opens at 1,116 and the NASDAQ at 2,265. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Senator Smith has now talked for 23 hours and 16 minutes. It is the most unusual and spectacular thing in the Senate annals. One lone and simple American holding the greatest floor in the land.
Get up there with that lady that's up on top of this Capitol dome, that lady that stands for liberty. Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something.
You know, they don't filibuster like they used to, do they? The idea that a solitary senator can start talking and keep talking and talking and talking for hours to stop some legislation, as they did in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, is now a quaint notion. We've been talking about this, dare we say, filibustering about this all week because of the Senate election in Massachusetts, of course. You heard about that one, right? Many, many listeners have written us and sent us their comments one way or another to mytake@thetakeaway.org or called us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE with their reactions. Todd Zwillick has been looking at some of these reactions. He's our Washington correspondent. He hopped on the Acela, and he's here with us in New York. Good to see you in person, Todd.
Hey, good morning, Miles.
Good morning. Two sets of comments from our listeners. Those who blame the rule.
The 60-vote rule is not the problem. The problem is that the Republicans, they are marching lockstep with only the political goal of ruining the president. That's the reason the Senate is dysfunctional, not the rules.
And then there are listeners who blame how politicians play the game.
The filibuster rule is a disaster for democracy. Since most of our senators are, in fact, bought and sold by campaign contributions, nothing of any significance, nothing of any fundamental strength will ever get through. And somehow or other, whether it's done through the Supreme Court, it has to be eliminated. Filibusters destroy change.
And I think we got those sound bites kind of backwards. But you get the idea.
Some people say
it's the rules. Some people say the way the rules are deployed. Which is it, Todd?
Yeah, it's do you hate the player or hate the game, right? That's the question in the modern parlance. You know, Miles, the anger over the filibuster and frustration over it is as old as the filibuster. People in the majority always hate it because it prevents the big things they want to do. So in this case today, Democrats across the country or liberal voters are probably livid because filibuster may prevent health care from passing, a big health care bill, or filibuster may prevent another big bill they want from passing. But, you know, in past years, the tables have always been turned. And when the Republicans were in the majority, the Democrats were happy to filibuster. So the filibuster defends the rights of the minority. If you want to run roughshod and get your way and do whatever you want, go be in the House. You know, if you want to have the rights of the minority protected and be a little bit more deliberative and have to sit and talk and decide things and gain consensus, that's why they have it in the Senate.
Which founding father said it? The Senate is the saucer that cools the
hot coffee. Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson. Yeah. Said. All right, so here, let's listen to another listener explaining why the filibuster matters.
If you didn't have the 60-vote supermajority rule, many issues would go back and forth every time the majority in Congress changed, and there'd be chaos.
So is that the reason to keep filibusters around?
It's a reason to keep filibusters around. That's what consensus does. It lets you pass bills that have staying power. If you could pass a gigantic health care bill, a big health care overhaul worth $1 trillion with 50 votes or 51 votes, well, in two elections when the other side's in control, they'll just repeal it. That's no way to run a system.
So maybe a supermajority is a good thing. All right. You talked also yesterday to the congressional historian, Donald Ritchie.
People have wanted to end the filibusters ever since they were filibusters. Whoever is the majority party has been elected to carry out its agenda. But the rules of the Senate have always given more power, more muscle to the minority. And that's always frustrated the majority, regardless of which party is in the majority.
So it just goes back and forth. The pendulum swings. Yeah, the math changes, and it's just a different group of people
right? But it has evolved, though, right? I mean, it hasn't always been used all the time.
It seems like it's used more, right?
Yeah, that seems true.
And it depends on what you define as a filibuster. Today, any objection that then requires 60 votes, and we won't get down into the weeds, that's called a filibuster. Today, the term filibuster no longer applies to standing on the Senate floor and reading the phone book.
Because they don't actually do that.
They don't actually do that.
Maybe they should.
Well,
and see it on C-SPAN.
Careful what you wish for, John. You want to give lawmakers even a larger platform to say whatever they want for as long as they want. They'd probably take advantage of it. They can do it if they want to. It's just out of fashion.
Or read from the telephone book.
It might constrain them. Though.
It might just do that.
It might
do the opposite. It's a virtual filibuster. Who knows? You know, you're right. But that brings us to our next caller, anonymously, who says that's part of the problem.
Why don't they change the filibuster rule back to when the guys actually had to speak and waste time?
Smart listener.
It stands now, you know, they bring a bill up. Joe Lieberman says, I filibuster. He can leave and get on, you know, a plane and spend the weekend at his cabin. If they actually had to stand there on C-SPAN and read recipes and let people see them wasting time, that would have a whole different impact. There would be a whole different emotional standing in the country.
I feel like I know this guy.
Yeah.
Did you call that in? So what would it take, though? Is it a simple rule change to require them to stand up there? Is that just a custom that they allow?
It's a cultural shift that they no longer do that. It is not a rules change. The rules on the filibuster, aside from the number that you need, you know, it used to be two-thirds. If you think the filibuster is bad now,
votes,
it used to be 67 until 1975. Now it's only 60. So it's... And before 1917, there was no way to cut off debate. There was no way to end a filibuster.
No cloture.
There was no cloture at all. So, you know, it's careful what you wish for. I'll say this because the Democrats are in control now and Democrats are frustrated now. Back in 2005, when George Bush wanted to pack the courts with his judicial nominees, the filibuster served the Democrats very well. And that's where you got to the nuclear option. That was because Democrats were threatening to filibuster George Bush's nominee. So back then, they liked it.
You know, I didn't realize the Senate had a historian. Are you, like, really good pals with him?
Don Ritchie? Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I've interviewed him a million times. He's a great guy.
Yeah, hangs out at the Monocle, right? Yeah, all right. Todd Zwillick, in from Washington, here in New York. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you guys.
What would we do without him? Coming up, we talk movies like we do every Friday. A trivia question, as usual, too. All about Sundance. Stay with us.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien.
In for Celeste Headlee. Right?
In for Celeste Headlee.
Right, who's going to be back on Monday. I'm John Hockenberry. Supreme Court, as we've mentioned, threw out a law yesterday, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill that was designed to limit the influence of big business and labor unions on elections. It ruled that corporations and unions now may spend as much as they want to support or oppose candidates for presidents and Congress. Joining us once again to talk about this really landmark ruling is Dahlia Lithwick, senior legal correspondent for Slate.com. Dahlia, good morning again.
Good morning.
So it seems to me there's some logic here that relates to precedent that I want to follow a little bit. When did the court establish that corporations were essentially people?
Well, you know, the corporations have always been given some special treatment, and certainly for decades now, there's been case law that says, hey, we've got to give corporations certain speech rights. We can regulate, you know, certain contributions, but not expenditures. So there's always been some sense that we have to treat corporations better than just, you know, some nothings.
Right.
The problem really was that there were two lines of cases, John. One that said, even though corporate money equals speech, we can still regulate it for anti-discrimination, anti-corruption principles. And then there was a line of cases that said, well, no, this is speech. What the court did yesterday was essentially gut a 2003 decision and a 1990 decision that said, even though this is corporate speech, it so kind of corrupts the marketplace of ideas, the marketplace of free expression, that we can regulate it. Yesterday, the court really said
that. Yeah.
Those cases are just flat wrong.
So it's really a connection of the doctrine of corporations are people and that money equals speech. Those are now connected, and essentially there are no restrictions. Listen to Democratic Senator Charles Schumer. He has a legal argument here that I want you to evaluate. Listen.
The Roberts Court has turned back the clock on our democracy by over a century. This disastrous decision paves the way for free and an unlimited special interest spending in our elections.
Schumer basically said you can falsely scream fire in a crowded theater because of libel laws, but when it comes to democracy versus corporate power and wealth, there's no balancing test. Is he right about that?
Well, he's right that what used to be a set of very nuanced laws, you could, have electioneering, money spent on electioneering as a corporation. You had to go through a PAC, right? There were ways to do it. And one of the things that's very tricky about Justice Kennedy's majority opinion is he talks consistently about a ban and about censorship and about thought control. Justice Stevens, in his dissent, says, wait, this isn't a ban. This isn't censorship. You just had to go through these very convoluted paths. Pathways. So you're quite right. What happened yesterday was we swept away all nuance. We swept away all mechanisms. Other than you still cannot directly contribute to a candidate and you still have these disclosure rules, the court upheld that you still have to disclose who you are in your ad. But
right.
Other than that, all of the doctrine, all of the architecture of McCain-Feingold, gone.
Kennedy is the swing, and this is Judge Roberts flexing some muscle, wouldn't you say? Yes or no?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the most interesting moments in Kennedy's opinion is when he says, we only had 4 votes in 2003. Yep. Now we have five.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm not Celeste Headlee. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for her all week. She's on vacation. John Hockenberry is here. He's been in Washington. He's back. And coming up, we're going to talk about movies. It's Friday. Get the popcorn going.
So we've got a trivia question for you too, Miles, and all of you out there listening. Yesterday was the first day of the Sundance Film Festival. We're going to actually talk to two people with films at the festival this year. Which of these former Sundance movies did not earn an Oscar nomination? Okay. Super Size Me, directed by Morgan Spurlock. Blood Simple, directed by the Coen brothers. Little Miss Sunshine, directed by Valerie Faris. Or The Motorcycle Diaries, directed by Walter Salles. Now, which one did not have an Oscar nomination? Call us with your guess at 8778-MY-TAKE, and we'll
did
get the
not.
Answer. Did not. Not. That's right. More about that in a few minutes.
All right. No wagering, please, as always. Right?
Oh, you can have to do that on your own.
Right now, let's check the leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. In Haiti, officials are planning a massive relocation of 400,000 people from makeshift camps to the outskirts of the capital. The move is an attempt to reduce the threat of disease. Hundreds of settlements across the city house homeless families with no sanitation and often no shelter at all. Here at home, Democrats are taking a breather on health care reform after losing the crucial Massachusetts Senate seat Tuesday. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the president thinks top-ranking Democrats are right to shift their focus.
Obviously, Tuesday resulted in new political circumstances. The president believes that the speaker and the majority leader are doing the right thing in giving this some time.
Lawmakers said pieces of the Senate and House bills that were already passed could be packaged together to get broader support from both parties.
Call it drama, call it comedy in the air. A New York to Kentucky flight was diverted to Philadelphia when a Jewish teen pulled out boxes containing scrolls for morning prayers. The commuter plane was greeted by police, bomb-sniffing dogs, and federal agents. The teen and his sister were later cleared to travel. Now, a look at international business. In a speech yesterday, Secretary Clinton called for a probe investigating Google's claim that cyber attacks had originated in China. China had stern words for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, calling her remarks on internet freedom harmful to U.S.-China relations. BBC's business correspondent Mark Gregory joins us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So Google has a sort of a business kind of narrative going in China, but there's also an international diplomacy narrative going here. Is Google sort of stuck in the middle, or are they driving this?
Well, kind of. Google, for the moment, is not actually saying anything. I suppose what's interesting about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's comments on Thursday and the very stiff response we've had from the Chinese Foreign Ministry is this really is the first time that the internet has become a major subject of international diplomacy. The internet, of course, has always been international in character, but it's grown up through a series of international technical protocols and kind of understandings between nations that have allowed the system to operate. Now it looks like the internet is going to be on the list of those subjects that world leaders always bang on about at summit meetings but never seem to agree on. So it's a kind of coming of the age for internet, if nothing else.
But is it also, Mark Gregory, Google running interference for a U.S. policy to try to improve internet freedom, and which probably has some human rights consequences in other realms besides the internet?
Well, Google said it was pulling out of China because it had suffered cyber attacks, and those originated within China. It would never said that fact, but perhaps in some way associated with the Chinese government. So that's really what's kind of driven Google's move. They entered China in 2006, and I suppose they took the decision after a while they couldn't hack it. The pressures on them were getting too great. They wanted to defend their public reputation. And, of course, although Google has a 35% share of the Chinese internet search market, actually, in financial terms, it's not that important at the moment to Google's overall operations.
That's brilliant what you said there, Mark. Google couldn't hack it in China. That's great.
I got that one.
BBC's business correspondent, Mark Gregory, joining us from London. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
All right, it's Friday, movie day at The Takeaway. Like swallows to Capistrano, stars, writers, directors, and movie groupies are descending once again on Park City, Utah, for the Sundance Film Festival. Today, we're talking to two directors who are premiering movies in this year's festival. For them, it's all about the buzz. Get people talking about your movie, and who knows, a year later, you may be thanking all the little people. Joining us, Tim Rutili. He's the director of All My Friends Are Funeral Singers. And Reed Cowan, director of 8, The Mormon Proposition. Gentlemen, good to have you with us on the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
We'll start with Tim. I think since, you know, this is about buzz for your movie, we're going to give you an opportunity right away to give us the elevator pitch on your movie.
To give us the elevator pitch?
Yeah. Sum up the movie. What's the movie about?
The movie is about a woman who is a fortune teller, and she lives in the woods in a house full of ghosts. And one day a light shows up in the woods, and the ghosts realize they're kind of trapped in the house. They start making her life kind of miserable.
We got a brief clip. Let's play it.
So what can I do for you today, Ted?
You're the psychic. You tell me.
Lots of spooky music there. All right, Reed, give us your pitch. Reed, you there? We've lost Reed. All right, we're going to continue on with Tim then. Tim, tell us how important Sundance is to you.
Well, it's incredibly important. It kind of came out of nowhere for us. We made this film. I play in a band called Caliphone, and we made this film to go along with our album. So it was kind of an unexpected thing. We submitted, and we didn't really expect that they would, you know, want to deal with us at all. But they called, and it's been pretty incredible to have this film treated as a film and not just something that goes along with the album that we made.
I think we've reconnected with Reed Cowan. Reed, you with me?
Hi, guys. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I gave Tim an opportunity to sort of give the basic thumbnail pitch on his movie. Why don't you tell us about your movie, 8, The Mormon Proposition?
All right, thank you so much. We're a full-length feature documentary that examines the role of the Mormon Church in the passage and promotion of California's Proposition 8, which literally stripped thousands of citizens of their civil rights.
So it's a documentary. Let's listen to a clip.
All right, thank you, everyone. We're getting new numbers now in on Proposition 8.
We calculated that 75% of all the money coming in is coming from Mormon families.
The Mormon Church has been leading the charge against same-sex marriage since 1995.
It would be better to be dead than be homosexual.
All right, now, Reed, you're a former Mormon missionary, correct?
I am.
All right, so where did this idea come to you? Were we in the middle of watching this debate unfold in California, and you thought this is a movie to make?
You know, we saw what was happening in California, and our film production team, in our investigation of Mormon involvement, came upon classified documents, some 1,500 documents from inside the Mormon Church archives that detailed a decades-long campaign against any LGBT rights that a person could claim, showing that Mormons have a hand in legislation and a hand in policymaking relative to gay people in pretty much every state in our country. And so when we came upon these documents and we saw what was happening in California relative to Mormon involvement in Proposition 8, we simply could not make the film. It had to be made.
I guess that makes you a black sheep in the family.
Yeah, I'm not very popular at family reunions these days.
I guess so. Wow. Tell us a little bit about what Sundance means to you. How important is this for you as you try to get the word out on your movie?
Could you repeat the question?
The question, Reed, is how important is Sundance to you in getting buzz about your movie and the success of your movie in general?
Well, Sundance is the biggest. It is the best. It is the greatest film festival in the world. And so literally, to get our message out at Sundance, and especially Ground Zero for Mormons, you know, it's huge. And, you know, the survivability of our film and the truths in our film depends on the success of the next 7 days. We've got to do the business. We've got to do it effectively here in Park City, Utah. We've got to move audiences in order for other audiences worldwide to see this over the next year or 2 years.
I suspect there'll be quite a few Mormons watching your movie. It'll be interesting to see how things go after those screenings. Reed Cowan, the director of 8, The Mormon Proposition. Tim Rutili, the director of All My Friends Are Funeral Singers. We wish you well in Park City, Utah.
My internet message buddy Mike from Maine got our trivia question. Here was the answer, or here was the question again. Which former Sundance movies did not earn an Oscar nomination? Super Size Me, Blood Simple, Little Miss Sunshine, or The Motorcycle Diaries? The answer was... Eh? Eh? The Coen Brothers, Blood Simple.
It's not fair. I saw
Mike got
it
wrong.
I can't get it.
You can play. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. Give your nominations for Good Week, Bad Week at the same place. You are...
listening, not watching. Your Takeaway.
Your name is Miles O'Brien, though.
That too.
All week long, I've had to deal with
this. I'm so confused.
John Huckabee.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.